Complaining about one's workload is pretty common, I would say, but I feel like we've reached a stage beyond complaining. Burnout has become the mental illness of the 21st century. I feel like it went from a condition that we would hear about every now and then to something that is really part of our lives because we know friends or family members who burn out. Burnout has become an essential part of our lives, something we're confronted with all the time. It doesn't matter if you're Gen Z, millennial, Gen X, or boomer, burnout is now a common feature of our lives under capitalism. Philosopher Byung-Chul Han wrote an entire book about it to kind of understand what it is, what are its origins. So in The Burnout Society, that's the book, he shows how the combination of hyperattention and what he calls the achievement society are responsible for that. So let's start with hyperattention. And yes, I did write my script on paper, and I feel very cool for doing it. So hyperattention refers to the fact that we're overstimulated with information or entertainment. We watch one TikTok video, and then another, and another, and it never ends. We're now so used to social media platforms being structured around the stream. For us, it's like a natural feature of social media, and that's precisely what requires or creates hyperattention. The term hyperattention, for example, implies that we're active in the process of scrolling and looking at all the content. Actually, in his book, Byung-Chul Han shows that social media platforms, social media giants, are very good at giving us the illusion that we have the power. He says that all those operations, all that work, free labor that we do for platforms, is presented to us as a form of unbounded freedom. But that's an illusion. The way our attention is distributed is predetermined by algorithms. We are never free on the internet, and the idea of hyperattention is so wrong, because hyperattention puts us not in a state of activity, but in a state of passivity. Okay, so that was hyperattention, now let's move on to the achievement society. So just to contextualize a little bit, in the 1960s, philosopher Michel Foucault explains that we lived under a disciplinary society where various forms of authority institutions tell us what to do. So from the school to the workplace, we have to obey and remain disciplined. Well, Byung-Chul Han challenges that a little bit. According to him, this is not how we live anymore. That's why he came up with a new term, the achievement society. To Han, we went from discipline, so you have to do this, you can't do that, to achievement. I can do this, I can do that. The discipline is no longer imposed on us, but comes from within. It is attached to the desire to self-actualize, to become the best version of yourself. He argues that this dynamic is super powerful and super pervasive because, once again, it gives the illusion of freedom. We choose to do a podcast, a YouTube channel, or, you know, to turn our hobby into a business. So we are in the era of the entrepreneurial self. For those of you who've been following my channel for a very long time, maybe that will make you think of the video I did on the creative entrepreneur. So according to Byung-Chul Han, the achievement society is responsible for the rise in burnout and depression. We tell ourselves that we're free, that we can achieve everything. So the pressure is no longer coming from the outside, it's coming from within. The philosopher Alain de Botton, behind the very popular YouTube channel The School of Life, once joked about the fact that self-help books like those of Anthony Robbins, for example, are often located in the same section as books on how to cope with depression, anxiety, loneliness, or self-hatred. You see, the false promises of self-help, or in our case, the achievement society, can lead to deception, depression, that can then even turn into resentment. I say resentment because the first time I was researching on that, it was in the context of better understanding incel culture. And the resentment that a lot of incels feel is, for me, very much related to that, to those false promises of the achievement society. You know, the if you work hard enough, if you spend a lot of time at the gym, then you're gonna be rich, you're gonna be successful, and you're gonna find a beautiful wife, you know? So anger, resentment, depression, a loss of meaning, a loss of identity. Basically, the combination of the achievement society and hyperattention is killing us, really. Byung-Chul Han wrote The Burnout Society in 2015. And last year, he published sort of a response to that, Vita Contemplativa, In Praise of Inactivity. It's a philosophical book that makes you want to quit your job, book a train ticket, go to the countryside, rent a cottage, write poetry, I don't know. But before we go deeper into the praise of inactivity, I first want to look at the way it was corrupted by the achievement society. I'll go back to the cottage core stuff later.
So what are the most common forms of inactivity? Sleep? Holidays? Well, Byung-Chul Han argues that they are still part of the logic of war. Capitalism has corrupted inactivity, basically. When it's the weekend, when we are on holidays, we're not active, we are resting so that we can be productive for the next day of work. That's why Han says that we must create a politics of inactivity that is able to produce genuinely free time. Because what do we do now when we want to rest? We scroll. The average screen time in the US is 7 hours and 4 minutes per day. So we passively let screen guide our attention and feed us with endless dopamine. Now, that's not what leisure is supposed to be. For Han, inactivity is related to contemplation, meaning the action of looking thoughtfully at something for a long time, Google says. Contemplation is aimless, and that, my friends, that is so at odds with what the achievement society wants. In the achievement society, everything needs to have a goal, to have a purpose. I'll share a quick anecdote. I'm French, and in France, the culture of the terrasse is a pretty big deal. The tables and seats on the terrasse usually face the streets to encourage contemplation. And when we meet in the evening to have a drink at the terrace, we don't necessarily have an idea of when this inactivity will end. We'll say let's meet at 7 p.m. and then go with the flow. When I go to the US or the UK, I don't really see that. The space in bars and cafes is organized in a way that does not really encourage contemplation. And friend states are usually scheduled, so that means that there's always a plan to the plan.
In the achievement society, even sleep must be carefully measured and optimized. It starts with the premise that your brain can be hacked, using neuroscience, a field of research that has become super trendy in the past decade. So neuroscientist Matthew Walker,
neuroscientist and best-selling author,
and one of the world's leading researchers in sleep science.
It's going to blow your mind.
I knew he was going to be my guy when I saw he was on the Diary of a CEO with Stephen Bartlett to talk about the 6 sleep hacks you need.
There's a global sleep loss epidemic shaped by this thing called the modern world.
He didn't drop the C word. Modern world, though, is a very apolitical way of saying capitalism.
Less sleep equals more productivity. That is just not true. Insufficient sleep costs most nations about $411 billion.
So that's Matthew, and he's not the only one doing that. That is exactly what Han means when he says that the achievement society corrupted sleep, and not just sleep. Look at an idea like the 4-day work week, for example. It started as a left-wing idea, a continuation of the long struggle for paid holidays, things like the 35-hour work week in France, etc. The 4-day work week wasn't invented a decade ago. Left-wing thinkers and economists have argued for it for a very long time. It just happens that it got more attention since COVID, as workers' expectations around work have changed and bosses have had to look out for new solutions. Studies have shown that the 4-day work week can boost productivity, and so that's it. You've got your perfect solution there. All of that to say that the logic behind the 4-day work week is still somewhat capitalist. The idea is to increase productivity using rest time more efficiently. Now, obviously, Han has a different view of inactivity, and so he writes, quote, "Inactivity has a logic of its own language, temporality, architecture, magnificence, even its own magic. It is not a weakness or defect, but rather an intensity, which is, however, neither seen or acknowledged in our active and performance-driven society. We cannot access the riches of the realm of inactivity. Inactivity is a radiance within human existence. Today, it has spelled into an emptiness within activity." End of the quote. So in his book Vita Contemplativa, Han demands that we completely change our approach of inactivity. He gave us a bunch of Tumblr or Instagram quotes like this one. "We owe true happiness to the useless and purposeless, to what is intentionally convoluted, what is unproductive, indirect, exuberant, superfluous, to beautiful forms and gestures that have no use and serve no purpose." Oh, here's another one, quote, "Inactivity is the condition of the possibility of experience." End of the quote. Quite cute, isn't it? So for Han, hyperattention in the form of endless scrolling is passive, and inactivity in the form of contemplation is active. He quotes Nietzsche, who wrote in the wake of the Industrial Revolution that, quote, "With the tremendous acceleration of life, mind and eye have become accustomed to seeing and judging partially or inaccurately, and everyone is like the traveler who gets to know a land and its people from a railway carriage." Now, reading this book made me think of the unpleasant feeling I had whenever I visited my grandmother at the care home she was staying at until she passed away last year. I was in a constant state of low anxiety, thinking about how bored the pensioners looked and how death was approaching, really. Boredom and death are two states of inactivity, so I found it interesting that those states tend to trigger my anxiety. I mean, even when I look at pets, sometimes I get a similar feeling. I can't stop thinking about how bored they must be, trapped in a house or a flat most of the day, how limited their lives are. But maybe I'm the problem, I don't know. You know, that feeling says a lot about me and how obsessed I am with productivity all the time. In fact, seeing my grandmother at the care home and doing things with her at a slow pace forced me to work on that. At the beginning, for example, I would bring some work with me, and after a few months, I stopped doing that. I made sure to simply be there, to sit on the bench with her, to look around us, to contemplate or talk to her, listen to her favorite songs with her, sing them to her even. It felt pointless at times because she would usually forget that we even came to say hi or what sort of activity we did, but I guess that's what Han referred to here. It doesn't have to have an outcome in order to be meaningful. Like, we're all gonna die, so when you really think about it, everything is a bit pointless. That's why depression is so common these days. We're exhausted to have to attach a purpose to everything we do. We live in denial of life's pointlessness instead of accepting it and creating meaning from there. You see, after my grandmother died, so during the funeral, we played the last song I played and sung to her when she was at the hospital, incapable of speaking. So she couldn't sing, she was going to pass away the next day, but this little useless gesture continues to mean a lot to me. Now, I've praised Han's work a lot in this video, but I also want to share some criticism. I want to go back to that quote I read earlier, quote, "We owe true happiness to the useless and purposeless, to what is intentionally convoluted, what is unproductive, indirect, exuberant, superfluous, to beautiful forms and gestures that have no use and serve no purpose." I read this thinking about what I feel when I contemplate. So when I go on a walk, when I sit and look out the window, when I go to an art gallery, is this really happiness that I feel? I wouldn't say so. I don't agree that happiness is achieved through contemplation. I think it's a different type of feeling. For me, it's a feeling of slight melancholy and clarity that I love. So I found it interesting that Han connected contemplation to happiness. It reflects our society's obsession with toxic positivity, you know, the idea that the ultimate goal in life is happiness and that things are only valuable if they bring happiness. I don't agree with that. I think that contemplation can bring up a bunch of different emotions, including sadness, but that doesn't make it less worthy. For me, a fulfilling life is a life full of emotions in all their variety: sadness, anger, joy, fear, love. This second point is going to sound very specific, but it connects to bigger topics. I feel like Han's book is, or can be read as, a manifesto for inactivity, and that in order to reach as many people as possible, Han chose to depoliticize inactivity. I mean, sure, as it is the case in his other books, Han criticizes neoliberalism, but I feel like the criticism isn't strong enough. He just drops the word neoliberalism here and there to remind us of his progressivism. In my opinion, it failed to compensate for the fact that there is a bit of a toxic cottage core vibe to this book. A, things were better before, emphasized by the fact that pretty much all the artists and thinkers he references in the book are white, European, and dead. Gosh, my wokeness is showing now, isn't it? The old white man again. I mean, he chose to reference those we perceive as archetypes of wisdom, people whose identities aren't political, and I think that's why the text is so easy to like, and why it has this sort of undisputable authority. Don't get me wrong, I really enjoyed Han's book, I love most of his work, and I love the idea of promoting contemplation, but gosh, my wokeness is showing now, isn't it? Well, the world of contemplation, the world of silence, for example, often feel like an ideal in our modern societies where everything is like go, 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 go. But we have to make an effort to think about who's creating all that noise, you know? Which voices are heard? For example, Han quotes Deleuze's Praise of Silence, quote, "What a relief to have nothing to say, the right to say nothing, because only then is there a chance of framing the rare, even rarer thing that might be worth saying." I resonated with that quote when I saw it in the book because I had already referenced it in one of my videos on technology. But this time, as I was reading it, I felt like there was something wrong. When I read this quote now, I think about the people who didn't choose silence, but whose stories were silenced or dismissed. I think about how eager they must be to speak up and be heard, or how they've been forced into a state of endless contemplation of the ways in which those who talk too much have mistreated them. I think about how eager they must be to finally tell us all the things they have discovered as they were contemplating, things that might be worth saying.
So it gets me thinking, can we talk about contemplation, inactivity, without romanticizing the past, without making it look like a rich people only fantasy? Well, yes, yes we can. 2 years ago, I went to an open rally of the leader of the French left, Jean-Luc Mélenchon. That was happening in Lille, in the north of France. So the north of France has suffered a lot from deindustrialization. It's one of the poorest areas in France. Mélenchon knew that when he came to Lille. But instead of talking about common working class topics like workers' rights, purchasing power, healthcare, etc., he chose to talk about something completely different. The right to quiet enjoyment. Yes, quiet enjoyment, a term that is normally used in private property law. But the more he went on talking about quiet enjoyment, the more it made sense. The independent media, Reporter, reported that 25 million French people are exposed to harmful noise, which mostly refers to the noise made by transports, trains, planes, roads, etc. But guess who's more likely to live close to heavy traffic, to airports, to train stations? The working class. That's why talking about the right to quiet enjoyment in the north of France makes a lot of sense. And you know, noise pollution isn't just a disturbance. It can increase your chance of developing cardiovascular diseases. It decreases your lifespan. Mélenchon also talked about the way noise and light pollution affects other living beings like birds, insects, and a bunch of other animals who struggle to orient themselves and find food for survival. So that means that the lives of working class people and biodiversity are hurt by the deafening and blinding forces of industrialized societies. They deserve a right to quiet enjoyment. Now, talking about social justice, imagine that the noise, the disturbance, isn't coming from cars or trains or planes. The noise, the disturbance, is coming from bombs.
أي موسيقى موسيقى بيتهوفن. الموسيقى هي تعودنا عليها بلاها ما بنحسن. هي نحن معتبرينها موسيقى.
This is the last garden of Aleppo, who eventually died from a bomb. He explained that the garden is a site of construction, life and hope, among destruction and despair. Locals came to the gardener to get flowers to brighten their day. In the past months, we've also heard about the olive trees burned in South Lebanon because of Israeli shelling. Vulnerable living beings, whether they are humans or animals, who took care of the land, who live on the land, are being displaced or destroyed by the forces of industrialization, the forces of unlimited growth, acceleration, and power. They've been quietly living and resisting against that noise, against that destruction. And today, more and more people are listening to them. I mean, it's true. I've seen more and more forms of collective resistance against hypertension, acceleration. Like, I'll give you a very concrete and very relevant example. Those of you who've been on YouTube for a long time might know about the retention editing style. Journalist Taylor Lawrence defines retention editing as the ideal way to keep a user glued to their screen, and she adds, this style features loud sound effects, fast cuts, flashing lights, and zero poses. Well, retention editing might be coming to an end. In her article for the Washington Post, Lawrence writes about MrBeast's tweet asking YouTubers to, quote, get rid of the ultra-fast-paced, oversteam era of content. He said that in the past year, he has slowed down his videos, focused more on storytelling, and, quote, let scenes breathe, yelled less, and focused on longer videos. And he still gets a lot of views, if not more views. She also writes about Sam Sulek's impressive rise on social media despite his super minimal style of editing. I'm highlighting this because I feel like it's a good example of the fact that hyperstimulation, super fast-paced content, acceleration in general is getting more and more criticized. And that criticism is no longer limited to, you know, niche communities on the internet, wellness communities, often anti-advertisement, anti-capitalist communities as well. No, that criticism is coming from MrBeast and Sam Sulek, who have millions of followers from various backgrounds.
So now it's time to develop that consciousness, to politicize it, to resist this idea that real quiet can only be found in non-political spaces, in bourgeois art or literature, rather than gardens amidst war, or the French protest against the retirement reform. I mean, the right to quiet enjoyment for all can only be achieved through politics. But in order to get there, we're going to have to make a lot of noise against those who want to keep us quiet. That's it for today. I hope you enjoyed it. As always, the conversation continues in the comment section, especially if you think that I misunderstood Han or if you have any comments to make about my comments on the book. Don't forget to like, to subscribe if it's not already done. I would like to thank my patrons for their support and a special thank to top tier patrons. We've got more and more crazy names. Tinfoil, Pancakes, Marshall, Trogdor, the Burninator, Brandon, James, Ujwal, Pablo, Patrick, Boris, Ria, Yvonne, Remy, Toki, Corrigi, Tristan, Patricia, Lenny, Ian, Donage, Ren, Alex, Manuel, Jay, Christopher, and Perry. And thank you to the other ones who prefer to stay anonymous. And finally, I need to talk to you about the sponsor of the video, Squarespace. Squarespace is an all-in-one platform to grow your presence online. They give you a bunch of tools to create your ideal websites. So this is mine so far, Alice Capel. I use it as a platform to kind of show all the work that I do on YouTube, my contributions, but also my book. I also added all my social media accounts. You also have analytical tools. You can run effective email campaigns. On their website, you can also get advice from professionals on how to build your website, etc. So many things you can do. So if you're interested in it, if you want to try it out, then go to squarespace.com to get a free trial. And once you're ready to go public, then you can go to squarespace.com/Alice Capel to get 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Thank you, Squarespace, for sponsoring the video. And yeah, that's it. See you very soon. Salut!
No.
Désolé.
That is saying hi.
Salut!